This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government.
Hello.
And we have a very special guest who I will allow to introduce himself, Colonel Devon.
Hey, Ethan Devon, and gentlemen, thank you very much for the opportunity. Thrilled to talk with you and the broader audience. A little bit about myself. Thrilled to be back at the Command and General Staff College. Started off armor officer, platoon leader, and staff in the 1st Cav. Then went to the Infantry Captain's Career Course, CAS Cube here. Opportunity to serve in 3rd Ranger Battalion after company command of the 1st Infantry Division. I had deployed a handful of times at that point, then came back to the Command and General Staff Officers course, inspired by all of my instructors, but predominantly a guy most folks might know is Dr. Mark Gurgis, who is my DMH rep. Then went off to field grade time in the 101st OCT at JRTC, Observer Controller Trainer. Commanded up in Alaska in 1st Squadron 40th Cav, G3 at 3rd Infantry Division, Fort Stewart, Georgia. My senior service college was a joint experience. And then some joint deployable time in Africa and Afghanistan. Brigade command back in the 3rd Infantry Division. And then served at the NTC and now find myself back here as the deputy commander. And literally walking the halls with real American heroes. So thank you for the opportunity.
So that's a lot of infantry time for our tank. Were you okay with that?
Well, not that I had had an identity crisis, but I'd enjoyed best athlete, not best, you know, insert branch here. And so benefited serving alongside both just maneuver experts and great opportunities. Great question, though.
Okay.
Yeah, so could you explain a little bit, particularly for listeners who maybe aren't familiar with how the building works, what exactly your role here is and all the different hats you wear, because there's a couple.
Yeah, thanks for the question. So first, I'm the provost of Army University, so responsible for walking arm-in-arm with the dean of academics to make sure we are doing the right thing. So think academic governance, working with accreditation, but also getting assessments about how we are delivering professional military education, and also innovating to use educational technology, best methods for delivering, and our relationship with Sergeant's Major Academy, the Warrant Officer Career College, Western Hemisphere Institute for Security. So kind of broad there. Then the Deputy Commandant for the Command and General Staff College, what folks are more experienced with, School for Command Prep, SAMS, School for Advanced Military Studies, and the Command and General Staff Officers course, but then also the Deputy Commander of the Combined Arms Center on behalf of General Beagle for education. So enterprise things, think tuition assistance and credentialing, which is what we also have in our portfolio. So awesome opportunity, like nothing I've done before, but glad that I'm serving alongside some experts and innovators in education.
Yeah, sir, one of the interesting things is about this is that in some cases, you have almost a command relationship, and in others, it's more of almost a special staff relationship. How do you kind of fit all that together?
Great question. It's about organizational leadership and knowing who has the most experience, best access to the info, but also has some great ideas about how we can do it better next time. So it's about getting the best kind of athletes, regardless of experience, but their exposure, their education, and their willingness to seek feedback and do it better, not just from the Army or the Joint Force, but also civilian education and agencies.
Okay, so almost more of a chief of staff role in some ways, more than a command role, although not entirely?
There are aspects of that. We've got uniform staff, uniform instructors, but also highly qualified civilian professionals that maybe have experience in the military or don't, but are incredibly well-educated and experts. And so putting them in a room together to develop and deliver, you know, professional military education better. Could be to warrant officers, could be to senior non-commissioned officers, could be civilians, could be to Army officers, or joint officers and interagency experts.
Mm-hmm. So one of the themes through a lot of the institutions you mentioned, whether SAMS or CGSOC or WNSEC, is history. And that's why we're here, of course. So I'd like to start off with a question I like to ask my students on the first day of history class. What is your favorite story from history?
That is an awesome question. So I started off really being super interested in the Civil War, but then when I started serving, my first really military history instructor was super into World War II. And I started learning more and more about Operation Torch and then Operation Overlord, mm-hmm. and have had the opportunity to learn more by serving in 1st Infantry Division, 101st and 3rd ID, more about those particular large joint forcible entry operations. Mm-hmm. Really came home with it resonating with me, the visceral leadership decisions that had to be made on the ground that were informed by some pretty Herculean planning efforts, really culminating walking the beaches of Omaha as a brigade commander, having served, you know, gone through Ranger school, but also served in the 75th Ranger Regiment, being surrounded by Rangers lead the way. But learning that when then Brigadier General Norm Cota, 28th ID DCG, when he said, "Rangers lead the way," it wasn't a war cry motto. It was part of, well, who's in charge here? The response was 5th Rangers. And he said, "Well, damn it, get up there and lead the way." Mm-hmm. It was not the kind of same inspirational thing that we assume it is, but still resonates and got the job done because it brought order from chaos and ultimately, you know, resulted in successful, you know, Omaha Beach over the crest and then beyond.
Now, so were you able to stay at Omaha Beach the whole time? So long time ago, 2012 or so, I had the opportunity to take some cadets out to Omaha, and we got to, we came and the tide was coming in, but we actually stayed all the way out to absolute low tide. Have you had the chance to see that tidal variance?
Not the entire thing, but as the tide was coming in, we got to see it creep towards us and then get all the way up to the shore and see the shoreline just disappear over a couple of hours, mm-hmm. and then walk up the bluffs. But as you're alluding to, incredibly dramatic. And to see what we asked our soldiers and leaders to do, coming off the boats, approaching, and then ultimately making their way, you know, mm-hmm. up against contested, well-defended positions, and ultimately, you know, lead to victory.
So you made a point that we've talked with prior guests about, and that's the advantage of being on the terrain, and particularly terrain like Omaha Beach that's all relatively still like it was in 1944. What did you take away, and what did your fellow soldiers take away from actually being on the beach versus reading about it or, you know, seeing Saving Private Ryan?
Riding on a boat with a plan, seeing, hearing, smelling what was likely happening as the ramps are dropped, and then having to figure out, am I in the right place? Are we organized the way we had planned? In the face of an enemy that absolutely has you in their developed engagement area, and what it must have taken to continue to assault, try to coordinate with the naval gunfire, the next echelon of forces, really not knowing when your resupplies were going to be established. Because the part we often don't talk about is that was the beachhead. Mm-hmm. We had to expand it and then start through a couple of different we'll just call them temporary reef systems to allow the large boats to come in and ultimately establish, you know, the train of supplies to start fighting. That was just the first step of a campaign into Europe. And so appreciating those initial steps and how incredibly heroic those folks had to be. But then compare that to equally heroic Utah Beach. You know, where it was just a different experience, 4th Infantry Division, you know, as they were moving forward. Just incredible to be there.
Teddy Roosevelt's in a famous point of, I'm changing the entire JFE plan right now because it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. The embodiment of, you know, mission command of seeing what we planned was not going to work out. Mm-hmm. Being decisive and on the ground and taking charge.
And I believe he was, what, 65 and a month from death?
Yeah. Absolutely incredible. I mentioned leadership And so it was the direct and organizational leadership. It is daunting and inspiring to stand there from both perspectives, looking back into the ocean, how we built the plan enabled by so much deception just to get us to there. And then you turn and look at what was ahead of us, up over the bluffs, into France, and knowing ultimately, hey, we had to get to the heart of Germany because that was our strategy. You know, it was going to be capitulation of, you know, of the Nazi, you know, the core, the center of gravity, the leadership, mm-hmm. if you will.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I always play with my students about, I teach an elective on World War II, and we spend some time, and they realize just how claustrophobic of a battlefield it is, where I ask them, what do you do when your core depth is 16 kilometers?
Yeah, we had to create that. And that's what there was, we'll just call it organizational optimism or commitment. We don't have, you have to succeed because there's nowhere else to go. You can't start spreading yourself laterally along the beach. You have to continue to progress, to expand, like you said, because we're going to bring supplies in.
Mm-hmm. You got to go someplace. And they're doing this with what we would now know as SINGARs or radios at best. Mm-hmm. No JCR, no digital communications. It's all analog, which just blows my mind every time I think about, mm-hmm. particularly the sustainment effort. When you bring all that stuff in, how are you keeping track of literally ships upon ships worth of stuff landing on a beach and then putting it in a warfighter's hand? That's impressive to me.
And I love what you did there. One of the lessons that I took away specifically, you know, jumps out, Atkinson's book, An Army at Dawn. Mm-hmm. We screwed up the way we loaded people and supplies to go on to, you know, the North African continent. We got it backwards in many ways. We learned that lesson by how we organized ourselves and then moved across the channel and then went into Normandy. For exactly that reason. Like, we knew we needed people, but then we needed stuff to support the continued fighting of the people, mm-hmm. and then to sustain and evacuate and care for folks.
Mm-hmm. Well, kind of to zoom out on this a little bit, a lot of times we, both people teaching in PME and military historians in general, we always come back to World War II. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that's something that is so relevant today, 80 years later, to the PME audience?
That's a really great question. Maybe because there are still veterans, you know, that are around or people can talk about it. It seems like we can connect with some of the technology, some of the lessons. We may have served over where, you know, those fights, those battles, the campaign was fought. Rather than sometimes even in our own backyards in the United States, things are overgrown. I remember my first staff ride was to Vicksburg, you know, as a young lieutenant out of a unit at Fort Hood. And walking around, it was neat. And you got the, you know, the hair, you know, stands up on you as you're walking that hallowed ground and talking about it. But it's also a little bit harder to connect to, I think, because the equipment is different. How long ago it was so different.
The ranges are just different. Understanding that the engagement area is literally 100 meters.
Mm-hmm. Technology and its impact on the fight is different. I agree.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned the kind of behind the scenes that a lot of people don't tend to focus on in a war, the size of World War II, right? I think if I'm correct, there are 2.5 million men on a line from the Channel to Switzerland by late 1944.
About that, and there's a lot more behind them.
Right, yeah, three army groups, and they're planning on acetate. That does seem a little detached from the modern battlefield that might be full of drone swarms and Blue Force Tracker and all that. So how do we tie the person looking forward, looking at maybe war in Ukraine right now, looking at war in the future, which is going to be a lot of man-on-man teaming and all of that, how do we tie them back to those 12th Army Group acetate maps, do you think, in a way that gives that meaning?
When I went to the Joint Advanced Warfighting School, my military instructor, Dr. Brian Greenwald, did a great job really highlighting joint, a role of intelligence, but really deception in setting the conditions for Operation Overlord. Mm-hmm. I think those three in particular are very relevant because the Army in our nation doesn't go alone when we fight. understanding where the enemy is, its capability, and how it is most likely going to employ itself, you know, the intelligence understanding, incredibly relevant and hard as technology evolves super quickly. Mm-hmm. There are times, even here in this building, we are taking observations and lessons and trying to integrate them so the students think about and appreciate what the future environment's going to look like. Mm-hmm. Deception is pretty incredible. As I wrestle with, you know, my experience as the commander of operations group at NTC, watching a division coming out as the principal, you know, lowest tactical warfighting echelon, brigades changing in their capabilities, there is a physical and mental space in between the division and the brigade that has to be overcome with unmanned, with artificial intelligence to help the speed of understanding and decisions, but also informed by there's a lot of doctrine and estimates and data you can ingest to help you do it faster. I think a lot of that intellectual brain power was happening by planners, and then it was, hey, here's the plan. They just have to go execute. There's going to be a certain dynamic. Leadership is always going to matter. We're just going to have more tools to help improve the understanding, and the environment's just going to change faster. And so there's still going to be a reliance on leadership, but a leveraging of tools.
So if I understood properly, basically it's the 6 inches of gray matter, developing that between your ears a lot more than mastery of any particular widget or gizmo that the Army might happen to have. Those are important, but this up here matters a lot more.
Technology can be incredibly powerful. It can be a catalyst for, you know, winning, losing, etc. One of the most powerful things about the Department of Military History here is it forces and strengthens critical thinking, that ability. You take, here's what happened previously, try to understand why, take away a so what, and infer it into what could happen in the future. That is what I found so helpful, and the way you just kind of described that and read back for clarity to me, I would 100% agree. Some of the history readings that I remember, still have on my bookshelves at home, you know, discussing revolution of military affairs, still resonate is, you know, we are going after technology, applying it in an innovative way, but our dominating capability that makes us successful as a nation has been and will always be, you know, the intellect of American leaders, our relationship with our multinational partners, and the ability to go do it together.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's really interesting about kind of the two eras you've brought out, first the U.S. Civil War, then World War II, is I think it's fair to say in both of those conflicts, an individual could still have an immense personal effect on operations. So Teddy Roosevelt Jr. on Utah Beach, of course, somebody like Grant in the Vicksburg campaign, or maybe a negative example, somebody like a Longstreet, who perhaps, you know, it's been a lot of debate about him, but his role at Gettysburg. You talk about the role of the individual and leadership in current future warfare. How does that work for a civilian who maybe doesn't understand that this stuff isn't all just plugged into an AI and that spits out the course of action? How does modern and future Army leadership work, informed by the learning that students do here?
I believe at the time, the way Napoleon gave guidance and diverged his forces, had them move separately and then converge at a decisive time and place leading to victory, mm-hmm. is applicable to how we as organizational leaders should think, give guidance, and fight. There are lessons there too. Because our battlefield is contested. Whether we're back in our command post and we have our subordinate commanders connected to us, we need to be able to rapidly give some guidance, and then we've got to diverge, because if we stay together, you are more targetable because of your electromagnetic signature, simple movement because it's saturated by UAS, a number of reasons. So centralized planning, decentralized execution, you can take those lessons from Napoleon. You can take them from potentially Civil War battlefields where you brought leaders together. I just finished reading a book on Grant that was an awful lot about, you know, selfless servant leadership, but also engagement and relationship management. Mm-hmm. Knowing who was the best athlete gave them the task that was the most decisive, or knew how fast a subordinate was going to respond and start moving.
Right.
And he would start changing the way he engaged or planned because of that. So talent management is still going to apply.
One of the things one of the references that I use with students when we're talking about command and control through telegraph is you can send more than just a couple of words, but it's still not you're not sending a 50-page operations order over the telegraph. So we say command and control by tweet. How do you command and control when literally you've got two or three sentences?
We, in our doctrine, in our organizational leadership courses, talk about the importance of intent. I think it becomes even more important. Repetitions in training to enable abbreviation and trust extended through initiative. But that's why staffs exist, too. Like, this is the Command and General Staff Officers course. Mm-hmm. Staffs help create the method to control when we're fighting. And they think for the commander, and they do thinking for the commander, and help the commander think too. And I think using history as vignettes to help leaders look into the future, while they're getting some reps here in kind of a safe space with, you know, the pipe hitting faculty around them that can, you know, nudge them in the right way, really, really powerful.
So let's pull on that thread a little bit and kind of look at this from both ends. The student who comes in here, senior captain, junior major, what do you hope that they have and understand coming into the CGSOC?
A foundation in direct level leadership and tactical application. And they come in hungry to be developed division and core level war fighting. So not just focusing on a fight or a battle, but how do you string together a series of victorious fights or battles by planning a campaign? Mm-hmm. So you're responsible for building operational framework, appreciating the environment as it evolves, and not being afraid of peer leadership, because you are going to show up of equal rank, but expect to be a first among equals when you graduate from here.
Now, sir, one of the interesting things that we hit here is that if you look at a standard staff group that we have here, you've maybe got a couple traditional combat arms guys in the classroom. You got an infantry officer, an armor officer, maybe, if you're lucky, you've got both in there. And then you got a couple fires guys, other duck hunters, air defenders, or a signal guy, a quartermaster. You might even have a chaplain. What do you tell the chaplain, or maybe that network systems signal officer who shows up and goes, "Hey, that's for these guys wearing cross cannons or cross rifles. It's not for me."
It's about organizational leadership. Majors are expected to be experts in their basic branch, competent across all. You have to be able to play all the athletes together. I think Patton talked about the musicians from Mars, right? Mm-hmm. That concept applies in spades here. I remember being, you know, fresh out of infantry camp's career course and serving in 3rd Ranger Battalion and being a successful tank company commander on up armored Humvees in Iraq, hearing an Air Force space and missile defense guy take me to school about theater ballistics and things like that. The division surgeon, who is a newly promoted lieutenant colonel, but in my staff group, talking about, you know, casualty estimates for a joint forcible entry. Having those conversations, pulling the chaplain in and saying, "Hey, large-scale combat operations, we're not planning for a memorial for 1-4. We're planning to lose an entire battalion. What's the effect on our ability to evacuate? How are we holding them in place because the environment doesn't actually allow us to retrograde them? We need to secure them where they are or keep fighting. What is the impact on how we fight and the force?" When we're wrestling with those kind of problems, mm-hmm. they still have to lead. They can't abdicate the responsibility as a field grade because nobody knows what their basic branch is or how wet the paint is on their new gold oak leaf. But there is a projection and an expectation on that.
And what role do you think the history curriculum and learning about military history plays in cultivating that organizational leadership?
So first, all of the faculty are organizational leaders and stewards of the profession, regardless of if they've worn a uniform or they're educated and a professional. All of our students should be looking at them and trying to decide, do I want to be like that when I grow up? Can I communicate as an expert? Can I develop and lead a team as an expert? And for history in particular, it is enabling them to think critically better, regardless of the problem, to help frame and understand. History is a lens by which you can help solve problems. There may be the answer back there, how to or how not to, or you can just take chunks of it as you're writing out a problem statement, you're developing options. It's a great way to communicate with senior leaders too. History is also known as an after-action review. It's just written by somebody that may be very well published and in a book rather than, you know, a PowerPoint slide deck. It's how to apply something that has happened before and help make what we're going to do in the future even better.
Yeah. General McClint, 19th Corps commander, artillery officer, relieved an infantry officer, highest ranking National Guard officer to rise to command in World War II. Or a German example, the regimental surgeon of a Fallschirmjäger regiment is commanding a rifle company to take a hill over Mulheim Airfield. Doesn't matter what your branch is, at the end of the day, you're going to be doing it.
I have benefited from serving alongside some great leaders that didn't get stuck on the fact that I was an armor officer, just saw that I could be an athlete and I could run race pace, and provided the opportunity. And I am in violent agreement. It's who can best help the organization. We expect our graduates to be value added on day one, as soon as they show up to their next organization.
Mm-hmm. On that point, one of the things that we often have to talk to our students about on the first day is we're not here to make you historians. We don't necessarily expect you to be in your headquarters next year or next decade talking about history. However, I think you've kind of gotten at some of those lessons. But how do you expect the graduate of CGSOC to then apply the history they've learned once they're back out in the force?
A couple different options. One, there's a relationship back to the department here because it's just a matter of time where you are asked to, through either a professional development series, help organize a staff ride, or just as a vignette for something you're going to do in the future, be able to take what they've experienced and apply it. When I was in 3rd Ranger Battalion, we reached back directly into Department of Military History. I mentioned, Dr. Mark Gerges, who was my historian in Staff Group 20 Alpha back in the day, seeing him here, the relationships that he's fostered, one of his students actually led our Normandy campaign staff ride when I was a brigade commander and we were forward in Europe. We brought all the command teams together and one of his pupils crushed it and led us through, hey, how we got here. Mm-hmm. And so you expect a major to be able to apply history.
Mm-hmm. And so we've spent a lot of time focused on Indo-PACOM, and obviously there's World War II history there as well as other history. What might you say to the student or just the general person who says, okay, this 1944 stuff is all well and good. What does that mean for combat in Indo-PACOM? Completely different environment, different players, etc.
Really great question. A book that I was given by a senior Army officer was The Admirals. And it is about how World War II five-star admirals began their service, in the Navy and then led in the Far East, so battles in the Pacific. The distances, the challenges to command and control, the movement of theater logistics, the establishment of forward basing to project air and land power, those are not new problems that we are wrestling with right now. There are just more domains and dimensions that we have to apply. Understanding technology, but not getting enamored by it as a silver bullet. Distance and the ability to command and control are always going to inhibit our operational tempo. Mm-hmm. Sustainment is the foundation of how we fight. And if you don't approach it that way, then you're going to struggle to command and control and turn a series of battles into a campaign, and a campaign ultimately into a strategy, and strategy to victory.
All right, so wrap-up question. What do you want students to take away from their history here and their time here, given that they have so many different things going on?
Really great question. I am in the process of reading Schifferle's book, America's School for War. It reminds us what Fort Leavenworth and the Commander General Staff School was built to do, and because of the organizational leadership lessons, the planning and execution repetitions, and the relationships that are fostered here through the lens of history, sustainment, tactics, and joint and leadership will help prepare them for what is next. This is 10 months where you get to focus on exercising the 6 inches between your ears, because the bar is very high when you graduate from this place. Your primary customer, who we are training you to help enable, is a division commander or a corps commander that is going to fight in a joint and all domain environment, because you've got to be able to employ all arms. You're going to meet people here and wrestle with academic problems in a safe space that are going to help you meet in a contested environment and deal with much stickier, pricklier problems in the future. And know that you've always got the faculty here that you can lean back on. If you need help, I have not heard somebody in this building say no. The answer is yes. We just got to figure out how to get to it, to help the force. That's why we exist. We are America's School for War. That's why we were built, and that is the charge to continue. Yeah, we got to innovate. Yeah, we're going to transform and deliver PME in a better way, but we still exist to help people lead and fight better. Period.
All right, Colonel Devin, very fascinating discussion. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for your time. It's my pleasure, gentlemen.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.